you aren't being a proper woman, therefore you must be a witch. You must be a witch.
Blessed be, my witches. It's the first day of spring, but it doesn't really feel like it, does it? Many of us are stuck at home in quarantine or self-isolation. Here in the woods, there is still a thick, frozen cover of snow and ice. For those of you trapped in the house, thank you for sharing your alone time with us. For those of you on the front lines, thank you for keeping our grocery stores, pharmacies, our hospitals open. You are our heroes. Remember, as witches, though we may be afraid, our power is stronger than our fear. Our compassion is stronger than our fear. If you can help, offer. If you need help, ask. As always, we are in this together. Close your eyes. Imagine goodness. With that in mind, for this episode, Risa spoke to visual artist Jennifer Hamilton about art and altars, all while keeping a safe distance. A safe physical distance, but no emotional distance.
Hello, missing witches, and welcome. It is Ostara, Eostar, Easter. It is equinox, and it is strange days out there. Dark and light reach another point of balance on the spinning wheel at Ostara. Light is increasing quickly, and the darkness will recede. But for this moment, they breathe together. In honor of the beginning of spring and in recognition of the weird suspended time of fear and pandemic and death facing, and also of the surging, life-affirming human kindness vibration that is right there alongside it, we can try to ritualize a bit of breathing room, maybe. We can open ourselves while we also close doors. This is the spring equinox. Day and night are equal. Our shadows, personal and collective, look us in the eye. And there is potential there for them to heal us. To celebrate and ritualize this turning, start from the mundane. Let's think about spring cleaning and focus that bright, windows open energy on our altars. If you don't have a space you think of as an altar, now is a beautiful time to begin. If some part of you resists the religious and authoritative history tangled up in the word altar, take inspiration from artist Jennifer Hamilton, who we talked to about her altars to the directions and about the altars of her home and about mantra and how we are called now to listen. An altar in your home can be as simple as a candle in a plate where you burn a cinnamon stick next to your favorite plant. Or it can be a glorious assemblage that looks like your soul and family history on the outside looking back at you. Either way, I think it's a choice and a declaration and a space for yourself that makes a container for your power. This spring, polish and clean and offer yourself this space again. I like windowsills, the space along the back of my desk where I sit facing the window when I'm writing. The tops of shelves, inside drawers, and a nice mug. An altar can be very small, and it is by nature very personal. First, empty the space and clean it lovingly. Use a little lemon juice or some of your own nice soap. For Ostara, add ancestors to your altar. Choose someone you've lost and use this as a way to find them. Choose an ancestor who speaks to your heart about resistance and survival. Someone who has represented loss and hardship and then change and new growth. Find an image of them and light them a candle. Bring them an offering you think they will like, a song, a story, a glass of beer, a cookie. Clean it away at the end of the day. Over the coming days, watch for items that seem like they belong. They just make sense. They resonate with the same frequency or they expand the idea for you of what the altar should be. In this interview, we talk about revelatory artist Hilma af Klint, but we didn't talk about her sister, who she lost when she was little to the flu. Or the way af Klint's spiritual practice might have originated in a simple longing to hear her sister's voice again. Let our art and our altars aid in our listening to all of those whose voices we've been missing, especially our little sisters. I found a small spoon with my daughter's name on it, a brass sparrow, a compass, some coral, nice lotion in a pink jar, a painting by my Nazi fighting grandmother, who is my daughter's namesake. With this Ostara episode, we offer you a mantra for these strange times and a blessing from all of us humming along together in our own versions of isolation and interconnection, that you will know your altar pieces when you see them. And that the time you spend curating this space of love and honor for the people who have fought for the future will weave you deeper in to that beautiful fight. Happy Ostara?
Yeah.
Missing Witches? Yeah, it feels so strange to be recording this episode. I was really excited to talk to you, all of our listeners, and to talk to our beautiful guest today, Jennifer Hamilton, the painter, about art and altars and celebration and spring, and it's warm. And we had to reschedule a couple times, and now we're in the midst of a global pandemic talking about art and altars, and it's, I think we're looking at each other from like kind of as far as we could possibly be across this room and a little wild-eyed.
Safe distance.
Yeah. How are you feeling, Jennifer?
I feel okay. I mean, I'm really lucky. I'm a lucky person, and I have a whole infrastructure for the apocalypse already prepared. And I was planning on being up at my house on the top of a mountain anyway.
Right.
I just wasn't expecting the entire rest of the world to be living this reclusive lifestyle at the same time. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm worried for other people. I'm worried for people in refugee camps. I'm worried for people that are underserved already. But for myself, I'm prepared for this. And I feel lucky for that.
Yeah, same. I had a strange feeling about it yesterday where our kid is like, she refuses the stroller now. She's like just hit this age where she wants to walk everywhere by herself, which means you have to slow down. Like, you have to, like, go way, way, way slower.
It's okay. There's nothing to do.
And there's nothing to do. There's, like, nowhere to go. And we're like, you were in the woods. So, yeah.
There's no FOMO right now. No one's missing out.
Right.
There's nothing to do.
Yeah, it's kind of a good feeling. Do you feel like it's affecting how you think about your painting?
Well, I'm working on a painting right now because I think I'm still having a show coming up. There's probably not going to be a vernissage, but I've been getting ready to have a show where there was just going to be one painting. So I'm still making that painting, and most of my paintings involve drawing a lot of tiny lines.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm still drawing my tiny lines, and I'm listening to the radio and just putting my energy into creating still. But I'm also mobilizing myself, you know, like, mm-hmm. I'm into gardening. I'm not a very good gardener, but part of getting prepared, I think, is planting seeds and watering them. So I'm doing that.
Yeah.
But in terms of making big art or like wanting to do a huge new project, I don't feel that. Mm-hmm. And for a while, I've been kind of getting ready for a long project that is very quiet and small, which it's an illuminated manuscript of the Book of Revelation.
Wow.
So that's what I'm gearing up to do. That's what I've been writing grant proposals to do next. And just in my own way, that's what I've been getting prepared for. So I guess I'll keep getting ready for that. I'll keep doing that. But I'm not going to make big paintings right now. I'm not going to try to do anything enormous. And I'm just going to hold still with everything that I've already got, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, I have a studio in the Balco downtown. I was going to move it up to Chabanel, and I decided not to do that, and that was before this whole outbreak. It was really just a decision based on logistics, but I feel like I need to stay as small as possible right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense too. It feels like there's sort of a coming inward right now, where normally I would kind of expect this like exploding or opening outward at this season, you know, that we would be sort of like feeling our flourishing, feeling our flower, but it's really like more of a little like protective little seed. We're like doing some seed gathering, some seed protecting kind of.
Well, up in the woods here, it's not like flourishing springtime yet.
Right.
I mean, at my house, there's still more than 6 feet of snow. Mm-hmm. So like the place where I'm planting my seeds, I snowshoe over there from my house. It doesn't have running water yet.
Mm-hmm.
It has electricity, so the building is warm. It has a nice south-facing window.
Mm-hmm.
So I have my pots all set up so that they can receive sunlight. But I'm literally watering them with icicles that I collect in a bucket. So there's no springtime as you
right.
would imagine it.
Right.
Yeah, it's really wintry still.
Right.
So I think it makes sense to be doing our quiet little organizational cleaning, seed planting work.
Mm-hmm.
In a dark place rather than in like an expanding bright place just yet.
Right. Can you talk about, before we talk more about the Book of Revelations, because I'm so interested in that project, and you've mentioned it to me before when you sent me an audio clip of your drone coven, and you were reading from the Book of Revelations, I think, in that piece?
Yes, exactly. And in fact, I'm using a process that I'm going to be using for my drawings when I recorded that piece. So that was with a group. We were meeting every Thursday, and it was in kind of a ritual setting at a friend's place, and we were making long, sustained music together, which was really an interesting process for us personally. I don't know if it sounds good, but I mean, we had fun doing it.
Yeah.
And that's all off for different reasons now. But when I was doing that, I was doing the process of Lectio Divina. So that's a mystical practice from the 11th century where you go through, you take a little piece of text. Usually it's from the Bible, that's what they were using, but I've done it with other texts as well, but it was meant to be done with the Bible when they did it back then. So you read over one little section of the text, and then your mind gets caught on a word, mm-hmm. usually, as you're reading, and then you just start looping that word like it's a mantra, and then you use that repetitive trance-like state to enter into a dialogue with the divine. Mm-hmm. And then you go into silence. So those are the four steps.
Mm-hmm.
So that process is what I did in this audio version when we did that piece, and it ended up on the word witch. And then, which in the text was W-H-I-C-H, but it sounded to me like witch, like earlier. And that's the process that I want to use for the drawings. So I've basically laid out a map in the same way that you would do like a Bible study of every single chapter of the Book of Revelations and how many lines are in it. And so I'll do one line per day, and that'll take 22 months, I think, because there's 22 chapters. I'm not going to do one every single day. I'll just make sure that if there's like, you know, 10 in a chapter, then I'll spread that out over the month. And then, but I'll be doing this practice of Lectio Divina, and I'll be doing my responses as drawings instead of as part of a song.
Wow.
Yeah. And then that'll give me enough meat, I think, like by doing that as my own personal research, that'll give me enough of what I need in order to kind of separate those drawings then into groups. And then I'll be creating something that's kind of like the carpet pages in the Book of Kells. Like intricate geometric probably drawings, although I'm not 100% sure what these things are going to end up looking like. And then I'd like to do a calligraphy version of the text, so I have to pick which text I feel like using, because there's many versions of the Bible. And then I'd like to do an academic style research that's kind of separate from my own spiritual research. And that's going to be looking into the mystics, because there's a lot of mystics like Hildegard of Bingen and Meister Eckhart and others who have use the Book of Revelation as source material in their own visions. You know, like it's just like us when we watch cartoons or movies, or we get images in our minds. At that time, one of the main sources of imagery would have been this book. So in the same sort of like a backwards way of what Carl Jung did when he wrote his Red Book, he has like a calligraphy manuscript with lots of beautiful images in it. And other scholars have gone and they've done footnotes and they've written in what he's referring to in his own writings.
Mm.
I'm going to do kind of a backwards version of that, or I hope to, which is to go through the mystical writings. Like once I have more of a familiarity with myself, yeah, with the text through my own practice of Lectio Divina, I want to go back into the mystical texts and look through and try to find where they're sourcing the Book of Revelation. Mm-hmm. And then when I do my own calligraphy version, I can do my footnotes and say, like, this is where Hildegard was saying this or whatever. And then that'll be like a whole big published book. But I think that that's going to take more than 10 years to do.
Right.
So even just the part of it where I'm doing my own drawings and I'm finding the source images, that's like 2 years approximately.
Right.
And then the academic research part of it, I think that's probably like another year or two. And then, yeah, doing the actual drawings and the finished drawings and the calligraphy version of the text and all that, that's many years of drawings.
So you're at a place in your mind where you're setting up on a 10-year project.
Yeah. Well, I just finished a 3-year project. Okay. And that was kind of an intense experience.
Yeah.
And I did that mostly by myself. I did that at my house. I purchased the land next to my house and I built a 600 square foot yurt on it. So it's a round building. And I was painting these 4 paintings in the round, and I was painting them by the wheel of the year. So that project was called The Altars to the Directions. Mm. There were 4 altar pieces. So each one was 6 feet by 12 feet. They're triptychs. So the middle panel is 6 by 6, and then there's 2 3 by 6 side panels. And I started that project on winter solstice. I worked for 3 months on the northern altar piece, which was in the north in the yurt at that time. And then on the spring equinox, I moved to the east. In the summer, I moved to the south. And then in the fall, I was in the west. And I did that tour around the 4 paintings 3 times. So each of the paintings got 3 months of attention. And then they sat there for 9 months while I worked on the other 3. So that project took 3 years. And I just finished it on the winter solstice of 2019. So I'm in a place where I've kind of been recalibrating anyway, just coming out of this big project. That was a private commission, so that was fully paid for. That was a project that now belongs to somebody else. And it never has been shown yet. Like, it was going to be shown on Nuit Blanche, but there were a whole bunch of things that fell through at the Balco and with the Nuit Blanche people and everything. And I honestly wasn't feeling ready. Like, I felt... Like, I didn't want to push it. There were a lot of barriers that were coming up that were kind of preventing that event from happening. And so it just seemed right to not do it. And now it looks like there's not going to be any events happening anywhere for some time. So I don't think that the paintings are going to be shown for sure. And I'm not even sure that they're going to get transported yet. So they're still at the Balco.
Wow.
They're still in my studio. I moved everything to the Balco 2 years into the project, because I was going bananas working on it up by myself on the mountaintop.
Yeah.
And so one of my main takeaway lessons from doing that project is that human beings need other people, that you can't really just go it alone. But now we're living in this strange time where you have to go it alone.
Yeah.
So I think we're just going to have to find other ways to stay connected. And I think the biggest one is going to be like physical touch. You know, I was really lucky because I have a dog who's very snuggly, and I have 2 big furry cats that I can cuddle.
Yeah.
And my friends would visit every once in a while. And, you know, I would go into the city every once in a while still, even when I was up in the woods. But human beings really, really, really do need each other. And there are things that happen to your mind when you are apart from other people. And so I think that coming into this time where people are going to be forced to isolate, that we have to take care of our own mental health in a way that we're not used to, you know, like self-care is our 24-hour job right now, like for everybody. And there's so many sneaky ways that our minds can work and try to like trick us into things and just like focus on the wrong things and go wild. So yeah, I think that we have to be really careful and really like take care of ourselves and each other and make sure that we stay connected.
Yeah, self-care right now. I mean, I think self-care has always been like a political act. Like, I think it's Audre Lorde said, I'll check that quote before the final of the episode, but it's also been like a commercialized act, you know, that it's been something that's been sold to us that we can do to continue our wage labor, mm-hmm. you know, and we can buy it from the closest provider of the new age, you know, that'll allow us to keep working. And so now I think we have to reclaim, you know, in this time where there's sort of this strange opening where you can see the difference between what's really necessary and then the sort of artifice. There's sort of an opening there to say, like, you know, caring for each other is necessary, touch is necessary, like, food and medicine are necessary, and you can't just sell those to the highest bidder, you know, like, we have to resist that, you know, even if like you and I were privileged and out in the mountains and we have our stores laid up and we have our gardens growing, you know, I find that an important reminder for myself at all times and right now more than ever, you know.
Well, there's a lot of self-care that you can do for free that you don't need to buy in a store and that you don't need any special equipment for. I would say that meditation is the main form of self-care that I'm using right now.
Are you?
I have a lot of different practices that I've done over the years. You know, I studied theology. That's what I did before I moved up to the woods. I got a theology degree, so I was kind of swimming around in the Christian traditions. But before that, I was doing a lot of yoga and other forms of meditation. And one of the surprise things that happened actually when I moved up here was that I found a Tibetan Buddhist meditation group in Warren Heights.
Wow.
So I've been practicing mantras and just different kinds of meditation that they do in that tradition. And I have found that to be very helpful. I went to a meeting, you know, they have a Tuesday night meditation group, and I hadn't been going that much because I've been mostly in the city. But I actually started moving up here a couple of weeks ago because, just for my own reasons, like the people that were renting out my house left. So I had, somebody has to be at my house. So I was like, I guess I'll go there because I was having trouble finding work in the city. And I just felt like being at my house, and I was like, oh, well, I'll figure out what I'm going to do with my apartment in the city. It doesn't matter. I'll just start heading up there. So I've been kind of preparing for like many months of just being in the woods by myself anyway. But I went to the meditation group because I was up here, and they were talking about the coronavirus. They were talking about how to cope and what the social distancing needs to be and, you know, really the nuts and bolts of it and, like, how are we going to take care of each other as a group? Like, if, because there's older people in the group, you know, I'm the youngest one in the group for sure, and I'm not that young. So, you know, people are going to need help maybe, and so because they're already a unit, they're already a sangha, it's a very small group of people, but they're already prepared to take care of each other, and they're talking about it. So that was really inspiring for me, and it just made me want to make those practices kind of like my anchor during this time. I also suggested it to other people on the internet. I made a big post on Facebook about what you can do to get through this period of quarantine. And meditation is one of the things. So, my meditation practice ends up being mantras a lot of the time now, but also just sitting in silence. And I think sending love or sending healing to other people and holding other people in your mind, I think that gets us into being other-centered instead of self-centered, because I think sometimes with self-care, we just get really focused on how do I deal with me. But really, one of the things to make your mind healthy is actually to think about other people or to think about other situations and other places and to be other-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that mantra meditation or like healing prayers, even, I think that all helps with that.
I think for myself and maybe a lot of our listeners, like, making a simple altar is kind of a stepping point towards a kind of meditation that is detached maybe from the religions we grew up in, that sort of is like an act of independence, you know, to find that spirituality or that quiet or that space. I guess your relationship with altars changed after spending 3 years doing the altars to the directions. How do you feel?
Yeah, I mean, those are not my only altars. Like, those are paintings that are intended to be in a space. And honestly, I don't understand that project completely. I can't believe that I got funded to do that and that I ended up being able to do that exercise.
Can you tell us what the space is or no?
No, I don't even know. I mean, that's the thing. It's like the person who purchased it, he has multiple places. So they're going to go stay in one of the places, but they're building another place. And then, you know, with everything that's going on, I just don't know where they're going to end up. I'm not really too sure about that. But yeah, those are paintings that are intended to be used as altarpieces. They're of the scale that, you know, like you would see Renaissance paintings. Even before that, like Byzantine altarpieces, you know? But yeah, my own practice of making altars, like, we're not at my house right now. I wish we could have been at my house. Because you would have seen what was going on. Like, pretty much any space that I'm occupying, I guess I do my own version of feng shui, you know? Like, I kind of place things intentionally. And so I have crystals, and I have things I find in nature, pictures, just little objects that represent something to me. And sometimes they're gifts. Like sometimes somebody will give me something and I'll place it in a special place. I usually try to consider the directions or which direction the surface is on. So, you know, like above my fireplace, for example, I have a hearth. So right now I placed my crystals are there, and like quite big ones, because I'm rehoming right now. Like in the middle of all of this pandemic and everything, I was just moving anyway. So I'm kind of just doing the same processes that I was going to, but with the realization that everybody is going through this incubation period right now. So that altar is in the, it's in roughly southeast. So it's like, I have certain connotations in my own mind about what the directions are and even what the seasons are. So I kind of just like put that into the altars in some way, or just kind of start by going around the directions. But there, I have altars everywhere. Like I have all, you know, even where my computer is kind of like an altar, or if I'm setting up a dresser, you know, like in my bedroom. Like things are placed. And then I'm also kind of disorganized and messy. So like sometimes and especially while I'm moving now, so I'll like find things and I'll be like, oh, this can't be here anymore. You know, like this platter that I laid out months ago with like salt and a letter to the lover that I'm hoping to meet and like a giant crystal and, you know, maybe a image of the flower of life or something like that, you know, that can't be on the dresser anymore. Like, no, we're not in that phase. So that has to go out near the door because I am ready to call this person in. You know what I mean?
Completely know you. Yeah. That is a conversation I'm having with my space at all times. Yeah. And it's also like, it's a way for me, like I'm not a tidy person and like my partner is, but he's an artist and he makes altars everywhere out of art and out of space and out of cleanliness and out of minimalism. And my altars are tend to be like quite chaotic, and or they have been over my life. So it's been a way for me of learning to go around the circle of my house and around my spaces and like dust them and tend to them, and then and kind of have that communication going of like, oh no, so this person, my daughter, is sort of safe now, and this whole piece was set up in a moment of like desperation, like hoping for her safety. So now it has to be a gratitude altar, and it's going to come into my bedroom, and it's this whole other feeling that has to go, and yeah, it's a whole other accumulation of pieces. And I think I feel more comfortable doing that because there were artists around when I was growing up, and that you were like allowed to have that communication with materials, you know? Do you have advice for people who maybe feel like they don't have that in their space yet at all? Like that feeling that they can make in it, they can make a creative choice in a space, or that they can make an altar?
Honestly, I think that the expression in the environment is just an extension of the listening that I'm used to doing. And I think that maybe I'm thinking these thoughts at myself, but maybe I'm being directed in some way also. So I guess I guess if somebody isn't used to taking directions about like what you're supposed to be doing at any given time, you know, following intuition mm-hmm. and just kind of knowing, like waiting until you know that that is the thing to do. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not a person who has the problem of like, it won't make the first step, you know, but I can imagine what that's like.
Right. Yeah.
And I would suggest like, just tune in. Like, tune in until you feel a feeling that, like, or, like, a nudge or a little suggestion, you know, hey, those dried roses that are in a bag, like, under the counter, you know, that you've been saving for tea, maybe they need to be in a pretty bowl mm-hmm. and put somewhere beside a bowl of water and beside maybe, I don't know, a piece of moss or something that you found mm-hmm. outside, and then maybe light a candle near those things. And if there's a piece of pretty material kicking around, like a handkerchief or a scarf that you're not wearing or whatever, like maybe just float that around kind of the back of all of those things. And then, oh, I don't know, maybe there's like a picture that somebody gave you that you stuck into a book a long time ago, and so you could go and grab that and like hide it underneath some part of this place and think a special thought that you want to accomplish. You know, like maybe there's an entire list that's completely different than that, but that comes when you start listening.
Yeah. Listeners, I wish you could see Jennifer's face while she's describing. She's like lit up, like she's like getting away with something. She's like got a scheme for you and she's so excited for you. It's really great. You look like you're 4 years old. Like, it's like, and maybe. And I think you're fucking so right. Also, it makes me want to talk to you now about Hilma af Klint.
Mm-hmm.
Because talk about someone who's listening, you know, like, and listening, and then also who put her pieces away for 10 years. Like, I was thinking about her when, or 20 years.
More and more. Yeah.
She said they couldn't be exhibited for 20 years, but then it ended up being, like,
no,
maybe.
She said they couldn't be exhibited until 20 years after her death.
Oh.
Yeah. And they were exhibited somewhat in her lifetime, but not very much. She is a Swedish artist. I love her so much. I really fell in love with her paintings many years ago, like maybe 5 years ago or more. And before I did the Altars to the Directions, I actually did a series of 25 paintings that is called Black and White and Rainbows that are based on the works of Hilma af Klint. I was so inspired when I saw her paintings. I had never seen them in person. I saw them on the internet, and then I ordered a catalog. I was already living up in the woods, so I walked to the mailbox, which is, you know, a kilometer away with my dog, and I picked up my package, and I ran home and looked at her. I just poured over her images, and, you know, they blew my mind. And I thought Black and White and Rainbows was the palette that she was using mm-hmm. for her colors. Her mm-hmm. colors I found really inspiring, and I later learned that she learned some of her color theory from Rudolf Steiner,
mm-hmm.
who I haven't really looked into much, but she is a very accomplished artist in her own right, and she was also very lucky to be at a level of privilege that she had studios in her lifetime, even mm-hmm. though she was a woman. And this is more than 100 years ago now. She was at the Academy, and she learned to paint. She was also involved in a spiritual group called mm-hmm. The Five, and they would meet once a week. They probably used a sort of Lutheran Christian base for their meetings. So what they were doing was they would do like a Bible study almost, and then they would kind of go into channeling.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the images that came out of those seances are these like scratchy maps almost.
Mm-hmm.
And she had this incredible group of paintings that she did. So she did huge paintings before any contemporary painters did that. She was like,
yeah, she's doing automatic writing, automatic drawing, like decades before. She's yeah, incredible. And the images, like 120 images to be exhibited in a spiral tower.
Yes.
That weren't exhibited until this year at the Guggenheim, in the spiral building of the Guggenheim.
Yes, exactly. I went to go see that show because, I mean, I love her, and I just also couldn't believe that the whole world was onto Helma now. Like, amazing. So I went down and I went to the show a couple times, and I spent a lot of time in the reading room and looked at the books and talked to the people that were there. Helma, she had her own way of doing things, and it was sort of scientific.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she kind of was doing intuitive readings of plants, even. Mm-hmm. So she has this whole series that's just these little tiny squares where she was getting into the feeling tone of the plant, and she was channeling information about it.
And she had this, like, scientific art background, too. She was super well-trained. She had painted for a veterinary school. She had painted, she had studied botany and painting, and then she brought all of it into this, like, space of painting. Like, I think in a piece I read, her nephew described it as, like, doing an abstract painting of plants at the cellular level.
Mm.
So beautiful.
Yeah, it's really hard to know when you're looking at her pieces whether you're zooming in really close on something that's micro, mm-hmm. or if you're way out in space somewhere looking at something enormous, mm-hmm. or like even whether scale is relevant, mm-hmm. when you're talking about the energetic worlds that she's really representing. Like, if you're talking about channeling something, you're talking about a spirit, I don't think you know what size the spirit is, you know. But her paintings were really big. The 10 largest, they're the ones that were shown in the little room kind of off the spiral of the Guggenheim. Those paintings look like you're inside of it feels like you're inside of a microscope when you're standing in front of them. So I had to go see that show in person. I couldn't live without not seeing that. And she really, really did inspire me. And honestly, I had a very beautiful full circle moment when I was at the show at the Guggenheim, because not only did her paintings make sense to me, but also my own work that I had been doing for these years by myself also made sense. And it felt like it was inside of a tradition, because I've always felt like I was kind of outside of what was going on in contemporary art. Like, I didn't go to Concordia. I went to Queen's University. They were way more about the materials than about the content of the work.
Okay.
So the way that I would try to explain my art to people or whatever, and the connections that I would make with my spiritual practices and my spiritual life, that didn't always fly in the contemporary art realms. Like, I'm not a popular contemporary artist. I'm not in magazines or anything. So when people were talking about Helma's work, when I read through the catalog from that Guggenheim show and I saw that people were actually accepting that she was channeling information, accepting that her work was coming out of a group spiritual practice instead of it being like an act of individual genius, and also just like a little ha-ha that the founder of abstraction is a woman. I love this, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, there were a lot of things about Helma that just made me feel like what I'm doing is okay. And also the fact that she wasn't really necessarily recognized in her own lifetime. I was like, okay, great. Like, I'll just keep doing it. I'll just keep making stuff. Like, I'm pretty lucky, and maybe I'll continue to have the resources to be able to paint for a long time. So I'm going to keep doing it, you know?
Yeah. We talked about arriving in your studio on another episode and the feeling of like stepping into like an artist's beautiful mathematical mind. And it did feel like we were in these paintings where we could have been zooming in and out of space and of the universe, and really like, I was pretty emotional, feeling like, you know, we should have met. You know, I missed you that day. I got there late, and then we proceeded to miss each other like 12 more times before this podcast. But yeah, there's something in there too, I think, for all of us right now, that like something else we've kind of been sold is this fame culture, you know. And maybe that's something else to put aside right now, and to, as we go kind of quietly into like listening to our own voices and doing our own work. And
well, it is being put aside whether we like it or not. There's not going to be any art fairs. There's no vernissage to go to.
Right.
There are no public events. Like if Nuit Blanche was scheduled 2 weeks later, it wouldn't have even happened at all.
Yeah.
So we won't have those same opportunities for some time. So I think that we're going to be asked to make work that is more accessible, or that is accessible in a way without purchasing it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that sometimes we think about accessibility as in, can we afford it? But I think that now accessibility is really going to be like, can people access it?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the accessibility factor is like, it, even though these are paintings, they're going to come in the form of a documentary, or even though, you know, the paintings are very big, that most people will just see them in a digital form, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or even this book that I want to make, like, that's going to be accessible. I won't be here for a while, but like anybody who's already working in illustration or already writing and or have the intention to publish, whether that's electronically or through a book, like that's accessible because people can actually have it in a space by themselves. You know, it's at the scale of contemplation already. I think we're being asked to enter into a phase of contemplation as opposed to like big public presentation. And honestly, like the art fairs have not appealed to me much. Maybe it's because I was not invited. But, you know, they're not going to happen right now.
I like that, the scale of contemplation. And I think, you know, accessibility in all of the different ways that we are challenged to rise to that right now is like an important work for us as witches and activists. You know, I think we're sharing a poem that was sent to us in this episode. It's very beautiful, created by an artist who's hard of hearing, and so asked us to also offer the transcription.
Mm-hmm.
And something we want to get better at, providing at least more of a description of the episode for the podcast itself. Thanks to, you know, some small support, like some incredible support from a small group of people, we no longer lose money making the podcast.
Congratulations.
But we definitely aren't paying transcription yet. But it's something to think about. And also to think about in terms of visual art, you know, like, can we describe what your paintings look like? Do you think we could share that with people? Can you describe how you think about them and what they look like? Can you walk us through the altars to the directions?
Okay. Well, we'll start in the altar of the north.
Okay.
So this is the most spacey, strange piece because I started it on December 21st, which is very cold. And I was doing it in an off-grid studio, so I was having to build a fire every day to work. And because the light is minimal at that time of year, I wasn't able to work for that many hours. So it's definitely the least detailed of all of them. And in the center of it, there's this like bulb that kind of emerges. And it has two floating things beside it that I call the sidekicks, which are these kind of like wiggly light beings, I would say. And the middle part is this like pre-birth incubus of a place where something is maybe being formed, but you don't really know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's made out of rainbows, obviously. And it's floating around in this pretty dark kind of bottom of the ocean type space that has things flying through it in groups of 108. There's like swimming pieces of other bits of things and a couple comets floating through the air or water as you see fit. And it's kind of like it's very dimly illuminated from the inside. I hope that's how it looks anyway. So that's kind of the mystery of before things happen. That's in the winter. And then we move over to the altar of the east, which is, I like to think of it as a skeleton of the sun that is rising up behind a mound. So there's this shape that is like a very symmetrical mountain. Emanating from that is more obvious rainbow lights. So like lines of little teeny tiny colors. So many of them. And then The mound itself is black, and behind it is almost like seeing through, like you would see through an x-ray machine, is a pretty complicated knot piece. So like my heritage tradition, my family is Scottish. I probably come from people who are in the Celtic and Gaelic. Well, I know I come from people who spoke Gaelic, but you know, like that kind of tradition. So some of the parts of these altars to the directions have these pretty complicated Celtic looking knots. So this is one of them. So it's like a big circle kind of, well, it's more like a hexagon kind of shape that's made up of little teeny tiny knots that are all interconnected. And it's kind of glowing gold. So I like to think of that as like a sun rising or a sun being born. And then in the summertime, the altar to the south, everything kind of dissolves. It's like the base of it is white. The colors, there's like little teeny tiny, like a waterfall of lines that are going through. There's like a middle waterfall, because this is kind of echoing the altar to the north, which has this bulb. So there's like a middle waterfall shape. And then in this case, the sidekicks are actually just straight up Celtic knot pieces based on the flower of life. So they look like two little baskets. And then coming out from both the sidekicks and alongside this big waterfall shape in the background, I did oil glazing. So it's like yellows and blues, but mostly white. And these little teeny tiny, like what I call angelic turbines, that are kind of like little whirlpools of very small, like pinwheels of very subtle, like very pale yellows and very pale blues that are almost white. And then inside of the waterfall, there's some lines that are rainbow colors and some lines that are just black. So the first year that I was working on it for 3 months, I did just the rainbow lines. And then the second year I did just inky black lines. So it has very teeny tiny lines inside of it. But that one is definitely the most abstract, although there are these kind of congregations of more knot-like and geometric pieces that happen in the middle of the waterfall. And then when you go to the altar of the west, things change completely because, everything dies, you know? And so I made something that was based on a piece by Leonardo da Vinci. He did a very complicated knot piece called a concatenation, which is one continuous line. So I did my own version of that. It's like a crazy wiggly version. It's not as symmetrical as his. And his was actually copied by Albrecht Dürer also. So I looked at both of those. But it's the most difficult thing I've ever tried to draw. So because the panel itself, the center panel is 6 feet by 6 feet, the knot piece takes up maybe close to 5 feet of it. But it's very, very tiny lines and very intricate. And I started building it in the center and then I gradually made it bigger. And every time I made it bigger, I had to solve the lines. So, you know, it ended up being about 6 months of work just on that. And then there's no color almost in that piece. I left the wood paneling somewhat visible. So I actually copied the lines of the wood grain and then used that as the base of my little tiny lines in all the space that goes around this infinity knot piece. And the way that it's colored in, like I did the negative space behind the knot in black, and then the positive line ended up being in white. And then the background of it is kind of like a very, 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 very pale version of many of the colors that are in the whole piece. And the inspiration for that kind of happened simultaneously to the method that I used to figure out how I was going to do that step. Like every step of this project came in little bits. But I was sitting in my living room at my house, and I already kind of knew that I wanted to do these like really pastel versions of all the colors. And I would still love to do another painting that is like a very true version of this idea, because I ran out of time. It ended up being like a more subtle version of this. But I was sitting in my house and they had called for a lightning storm. And so I had never seen that in the weather forecast before, and so I was just inside. I had my dog and my cats with me, and I heard the thunder at the same time as I saw something. Mm-hmm. It was very loud and extremely bright, and it was like the outside completely disappeared. Like, instead of being able to see trees and snow from out my window, all I saw for a second was, like, the brightest light that you've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And it was like there were rainbows inside of the light. So I knew that I was, like, I knew that either my house got hit by lightning or I was very close to the lightning. And so, obviously, it scared the crap out of the animals. My dog started barking. My cats ran away. I was electrified, quite literally, and was afraid to move. Because I thought, what if there's sparks? I was kind of waiting a few minutes to see if the house was on fire, yeah. You know? And then I, like, kind of slowly got up and started walking around. And, okay, no, everything seems to be okay here. I didn't go outside because I was scared that there was still lightning going on. But then later in the day, I went out and I saw that there was a branch down. So I think the lightning kind of came over my house and, like, just hit the tree very close to it. But it was like in the movie Beetlejuice when they open the door out into the sandworm world.
Yeah.
It felt like that for a second, like the whole world disappeared and it was like lightning. I was like, okay, so I guess that's what that like light rainbow thing is all about. So I kind of feel like the Altar of the West has this like flash, little flash of lightning, you know, behind it. But that's like the death moment of the whole thing.
Mm. Well, that's your auditory altar, my friends. I don't know how to follow that. I feel like my mind is full of all these incredible images now. So maybe here's my suggestion. I think, you know, what else you got to do, people? You're home. You're taking some quiet. Why don't you find some drawing implements and try to see if you can be inspired by some of those descriptions. And build them into your altars. And maybe, Jen, would you feel like sharing with us? You said you're working with mantra, which we could talk about for another hour. I've just been writing about a 14th century Kashmiri mystic, Lala Dead, and the use of mantra. But we'll leave that for another time, I guess. But, Can you share a mantra with us? Can you share how you're, maybe a mantra that is giving you strength and solace that people can carry with them out of the end of this podcast and into these strange days?
I can give you my recipe that I'm using for mantras right now, I guess.
That sounds amazing. What's your recipe? what's a mantra recipe?
Well, I just mean, like, when I sit down to do my meditations now, what I'm doing is, I use a mala, so it has 108 beads on it, and it has a broken bead, like, it has one that I had to glue back together, which is at 23 away from the main bead, that has, like, a tassel hanging from it. So what I do is, I'm doing, like, a warm-up. I do 108 Om Mani Padme Hum. That's the mantra of Avalokiteshvara or Chenrezig. And that mantra is available to everyone. It is like free Wi-Fi. So you don't have to have a special ritual or anything to be doing that mantra. So Om Mani Padme Hum is a great, great mantra for everyone to use all of the time because it is a mantra of compassion. So anyway, I kind of warm up by doing 108 of those. And then I go to the bead that's broken. That's at the 23rd mark. And I do 23 of the 108 syllable mantra of Vajrasattva. And then I do as many full malas as I feel like. I need to get into like a more regular rhythm of this so that I can be working towards a million. But the one that I'm taking to heart right now is the mantra for White Tara. And so I, you know, like this morning I did the mala three times of that. Yesterday I did two before. I did the process of like 108 Om Mani Padme Hum, 23 of the Vajrasattva, and then I did two malas before I went to bed. Or like in the morning I did that same recipe and did three. So it'll probably become more and more every day as I'm doing this. But the mantra that I'm doing now. I don't even know if I'm really allowed to say it.
Could you share? 23 for me is one of those numbers, eh, that just sort of echoes endlessly all across your whole life, and it's so bizarre.
Okay.
And the fact that you hit the 23 is the broken one for me is, I mean, that's so perfect. You know, we're at the sort of broken part of the bead, I think, but it's also the seed. Would you feel comfortable doing 23 of just the mantra that's available to everyone, the free Wi-Fi mantra?
Sure. I can do that. Om Mani Padme Hum, 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 Om Mani
Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. Thanks. Be safe, guys. We love you.
We're going to leave you for today with some listener poetry. In our last episode, I asked for y'all to send me your poetry, and you witches delivered. If you'd like to be included in a future episode, just record a voice memo of one of your poems and send it to missingwitches@gmail.com. We are living for your witch poetry. Here's a quickie I wrote, and then we'll hear from Ed and Celeste. Sometimes I pretend the sound of cars rushing by is waves crashing on a shore, and no one is in a hurry.
This poem was written after a poem called Unholy Missions by Bob Kaufman. It was produced in response to a prompt that was created by Victoria Sepulveda and Anna Morrison. And that prompt was created in response to an assignment given by Tongo Eisen Martin. I humbly thank all four of these poets for their part in co-creating this work. It would not exist without them. My name is Ed Marlowe Herzl, and this poem is 8 spells for the first month of living through it. I want to define a monogrammed windbreaker as justification for an ass kicking. I want 80 angels, the wheels and eyes kind, to guide my sisters home from the club. I want to redact the White House. I want to spit an ear out on concrete. I want the bar it happened in razed to ash. I want an abortion clinic. Just abortion, only abortion, weaponized with abortion, built on the ashes of that bar. I want to punch him again.
Hey everybody, my name is Celeste Mott. I'm a witch and poet and tarot card reader based in New Orleans, Louisiana. And I write under the name Kia Alice Groom. My first chapbook just came out from Pork Belly Press. It's called Lucid, a micro-memoir. It's a sort of 50-50 lyric narrative poetry memoir. And it's based around witchcraft and healing from trauma and the Tibetan concept of the tulpa, or the thought form. This poem is called Shepherd's Scale. And it begins with a little quote. A strange loop arises when, by moving only upward or downward through a hierarchical system, one finds oneself back to where one started. Loop strange. Shape of house hollow, splinters, a series of locked doors, You speak in descending pitch. Cassettes unravel in the tape deck. I cock my head to the wall and look for omens. Bone crown, a shuddering sets in. Deer crown, the yellow walls speak backwards. Crown of torn up journals, crown of old prescriptions, making myth from pure exhaustion. It's my fairy tale now. Closer, come. Fold me like moth wings. Prism the kiss of my eyelids, the keloid twist of closing. Pine heart, palms to the beat of the boards, the house recovering language sings, stained glass. We hang like mist. Pitch descended. Speak and the doors unlock. I splinter hollow household. Strange loop, strange loop.